The Deuteronomists provide, besides writing, composing the Book of Deuteronomy in a number of stages, they are the ones who have the main perspective at looking at their history, right from the time of Joshua, right through till the exile. They have the dominant view of that, and that's what you get when you read the Bible. We're now moving to another school, the priestly school, responsible for a lot of the Torah. In fact, the main parts of it are all in this one book of mine called A Priestly Kingdom and a Holy Nation. Covers the books of Exodus, which is partly from the priests, partly from the Deuteronomists and other influences, the book of Leviticus, which is entirely from the priests, and the book of Numbers, which is, to all intents and purposes, entirely from the priestly school. So the Deuteronomic school focused on the need for obedience and fidelity. The blessings of the covenant depended on Israel's fidelity. The priestly school sought for a foundation that was more basic than human fidelity or infidelity. And they found it in the unilateral and unconditional covenant which God made with Abraham. That's the foundation of it. It's unconditional. The Deuteronomic school, it's all conditional on our behavior. Obedience matters, of course, but God's gift of God's self to Israel transcends our sin. Yahweh is the creator of the universe. The priestly school highlights the presence and redeeming action of Yahweh in the life of Israel, the mysterious one, the sacred one, the presence. They were, as one would expect, interested in cult, interested in prayer, but only as a response to Yahweh's presence in the life of the community. And one of their key themes is that of glory. Kabod in Hebrew really means weight. So glory as meaning the impressive presence of Yahweh mysteriously in every aspect of the life of Israel. Let's look at some examples of the glory of Yahweh in the cult. The last words of Exodus, chapter 40, verse 34 to 35, Yahweh takes possession of the tent of meeting and journeys with Israel, leading his people through the wilderness to the promised land. Here's the text part of it. The cloud covered the tent of meeting. Please don't imagine some kind of Sirius or some dash cloud. It's bigger than that. This is the same cloud that enveloped Jesus when he was taken into heaven. And it wasn't one of these things hanging around in the sky. This is the cloud of unknowing. This is something mysterious beyond anything we can. So it's talking about a presence that's wrapped in mystery. So the cloud covered the tent of meeting. The glory, here's the word of Yahweh, filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because of the cloud that settled on it. The glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. If I'd thought this through better before I came here, I would have brought the Jerusalem Bible translation, but I haven't got it, so I'll tell you what it says here. The cloud entered the tent of meeting, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, etc. Whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on the next stage of their journey. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day when it was taken up. So everything's guided by the presence. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, before the eyes of the house of Israel. And Jerusalem Bible says, and so it was for every stage of their journey. Leviticus 9:23, Yahweh manifests his glory during the inauguration of the cult. Here is the text. Moses and Aaron entered the tent of meeting, then came out and blessed the people, and the glory of Yahweh appeared to all the people. By the way, this kind of language is what was behind the liturgical revival that's quite magnificent, really, leading up to the Second Vatican Council and then opening up into our present liturgical form. But what they keep insisting on, and we keep failing in, is to make sure there's plenty of silence and make sure there's the sense of mystery and don't hurry it. And the fact that we're all seeing and all gathered around is beautiful, but we're in a sacred space. Remember the old altars we used to have with the angels on each side of the altar? That was another symbolic statement of heaven, of God's presence. So in our liturgy, in other words, as you know, it's not just a gather, our gathering to chat about anything. It's entering into this place where the glory of God is there. That doesn't mean, some people think it does, and I don't, so when you're the parish priest, you've got a fair bit of power. People thought no one should talk in the church. What we used to do at Kippax, I thought, worked well. People would come into the church and chatter, chatter, and chatter. But then, boing, absolute silence. And then we'd enter into the liturgy. Because we're coming to meet, we're coming to be. But there has to be a moment when we stop all that and just whatever. Glory in the life of Israel. Exodus 14:4 and later on. Yahweh frees Israel and defeats the power of Egypt. And here's the text. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Just stop. I hope by now you don't even need my help in this. Obviously God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart. He's not around here. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened. So can you see from their perspective? Well, God must have done it. Because everything comes from God, you see, as they understand it. The balance between freedom and the mystery is not there. So Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He will pursue them so that I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. A strange theology in a way, but there it is in the book of Exodus. God hardens Pharaoh's heart, so they're saying, so that Pharaoh will be stubborn. Finally, they'll be let go and we'll see that God is more powerful than Pharaoh. The God, the great God of the Egyptians, Ra, is the God of the sun. And you recall, the darkness covered the whole earth. God is more powerful than Ra. The other great powerful king, Lord, in the Egyptian world was the Nile, of course. The Nile River, which is the source of everything that grows in Egypt. And yet, one of the other famous miracles, one of the other plagues, was when the Nile turned to blood. So God has killed the God of the Nile. You can see the drama in it, I'm sure. Just gotta, when you read the Bible, you have to do a bit of Shakespeare first and then get into it. Exodus 16:10 reads, the glory of Yahweh appeared in the cloud. Yahweh spoke to Moses and said, I've heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread. then you'll know that I am Yahweh, your God. Exodus 24, the glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai and the cloud covered it for 6 days. Numbers 26 reads, Moses and Aaron went away from the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting. They fell on their faces and the glory of Yahweh appeared to them. Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, take the staff, assemble a congregation, you and your brother Aaron, and command the rock before their eyes to yield its water. And Moses strikes the rock, a symbol of God, of course. Nothing happens, so he strikes it again. He doubts. That's why he didn't get into the promised land, by the way. That's why he had to die in Moab. It's all pretty tough, but anyhow, there it is. And from the rock, as you know, we strike God, and from the rock comes water. And you know in the New Testament where that becomes a central image, surely. The piercing of Jesus' side, the rock, God, pierced by us, by our sin. And the response from the rock, from God, is forgiveness, baptism, water. All these symbols held together. It seems that the key role in composing the Torah as we have it was taken by priests. Beginning perhaps in the reign of Josiah towards the close of the 7th century and continuing during the exile and for a number of generations after the return to Judah, it was probably the priestly school who played a leading role in linking the narratives of creation and the flood, the patriarchal narrative and the Exodus narrative in one work, the work we call the Torah. And so they produced Genesis, not just on their own, but that's there, Exodus, Leviticus, and later in the period of the exile, Numbers, which comes in to qualify and update the legal cultic requirements in the book of Leviticus, which no longer work in a new situation. So they bring in new material. Their primary interest, as one would expect, was to ensure that the relationship of Israel with Yahweh was in accordance with the traditions that are handed down. Besides reflecting on their own experience, they studied the manuscripts, of course, including the priestly material that they inherited. They were intent on ensuring that every aspect of God's revealed will would be obeyed in the cult. Their work during the Babylonian exile was done under the shadow of the tragic destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And it's not difficult to imagine that. The priests are taken into exile. There's no temple. There's no cult. There are no sacrifices. So they've got space to ponder and to put in writing what their memory of the cult was, because they may not be able to hand it on anymore, because they're not giving it to their son, because they're not doing it. So they get a record of it as best they can, and they're trying to be faithful to the bit they picked up from Shiloh or brought down from up from Shechem or in Jerusalem. Whatever the material they've got, we're not sure, but they're creating this expanded story. Their work in the period after the exile, after they've returned now and come back, and they're now rebuilding our temple, was done in the light of this miraculous return to the holy city and the reconstruction of the temple, in which the priests had a primary role, and the high priest, that's what it's first called, the high priest, the leading priest, is really running their life. In his introduction to reading the Pentateuch, Jean-Louis Scar, S.J., writes this. The legislative texts and narratives have been reread, corrected, reinterpreted, and updated several times in accordance with new situations and the need to answer new questions. I hope that kind of phrase is becoming familiar to you now. It's terribly important, because I suppose before I was able to study all this, I took the word was there and it was kind of there. Little did I know how much reconstructing has gone on, reimagining, re-updating, etc. He goes on to say a little later in the book, the reconstruction of the temple and the restoration of a faith community within the Persian Empire created a new situation that undoubtedly called for the revision and reinterpretation of the data presented by the sources and the most ancient traditions. It was a living word. Scar speaks of the priestly writer, and he says, quote, he knows the ancient sources and presupposes that the reader knows them. He dialogues with these traditions, corrects and interprets them, reinterprets them, and proposes a new vision of Israel's history. And throughout all of this, the priestly writer, priestly school, but someone has to do the writing, he develops his own theology, which is both independent of and related to the ancient tradition. A good way of entering into this complex material, but not too complex, and for dating the work of the priestly school, is found when you look at the Torah and you look at the main covenants that are in there. The oldest is the covenant code that's now found in Exodus 21 to 23. It's clearly pre-exilic and very ancient. So that's kept there. The next one in time is the Deuteronomic code, which is found between Deuteronomy 12 to Deuteronomy 26. And that seems to have emerged at the time of King Josiah, prior to the exile. There's also the Deuteronomic theology, the end of the monarchy and the exile. I did that with you in the last thing. Then comes the priestly narrative after the return from exile and the holiness code, which is Leviticus 17 to 26, which is post those other codes. So there's a range of dates from which these various codes emerge. They're independent, they're related, but they're not identical. Let's look at the book of Exodus first, then I'll look at Leviticus and Numbers. In the book of Exodus, we read the story of the escape of the Hebrew slaves from Egypt under the leadership of Moses. We read of their journey to Mount Sinai and the revelation they receive there. In the book of Exodus, we find the core of Israel's faith. It's the most important book, I suggest, in the whole of the Old Testament. Beautiful book, full of wonderful imagery and drama. And there it is. It's possible that parts of the story of the Exodus go back to an experience of slaves who escaped from Egypt. It's based on something. And they journeyed in the Sinai wilderness. I'll come over this again later, by the way, but just for now. Where they formed into a religious community, these escaped slaves. They were bound together by their commitment to each other and to God under the name of Yahweh, the liberator God whom they believed was responsible for their escape. It's almost impossible to imagine that didn't happen, but not to the extent that the Bible will have it. A massive group of people escape. No, it had to be a fairly small group to manage it. So anyhow, so that's the kind of basis back in the mist of time of this story, this something that happened. The sequence of events that we now have in the book of Exodus is a late construction that weaves together several traditions of various groups to create a unique collective memory of the special people. We haven't the faintest idea what the route was through the... I've got one there for you. That's the traditional one going down to Mount Sinai, down in the bottom of the... Nobody knows. That's just a very late reconstruction, and that's a place where we celebrate all this. If you've ever been to Mount Sinai, you can see why. It's a wonderful mountain in a wonderful area. So that's where we religiously remember all this. But no one can say that's where it happened. We haven't got the evidence for that. So there are something happened, and it's been blended into this story. And I will be doing that with you later. One can imagine the story of the Exodus, the story of it, holding a special power for the tribes in the hill country of Canaan. Because they too were a subject people, the Philistines along the coast. Philistines had use of iron. They had chariot wheels. You couldn't beat them on the flat. So these people who escaped from the marauding of the Philistines went into the hill country where the chariots can't do much. So that was for their protection. And they were subject. So when these, whoever they were, when these people came in from the desert with a new idea of God, totally new idea of God, everyone else's idea of God was the God of the Pharaoh. God was the God of the king. God was the God of the temple, the mountain. God was always the powerful one who kept the status quo and kept the people in power who were in power. Suddenly, you've got an idea of God that's absolutely new. God is the God of slaves. God is the God of the poor. God is the God who wants to liberate people from the status quo. This is, well, you can imagine that kind of an idea of God being picked up by these people who are subject and frightened and every now and then attacked. They thought this is the kind of God we could bind together with. Perhaps the Exodus story encouraged the northern kingdom in the struggle against Assyrian power. All right, God protected us from Egypt. Maybe God will protect us from Assyria, the way he did our ancient ancestors way back. The prophets certainly used it in their critique of the abuses of government and the life that they opposed in the name of Yahweh. And I want to just read you bits of this because the account in the book of Exodus is probably 5th century BC. I'm going to now read you material that comes from the 8th century BC. The prophets, it's old, much older than this, but they talk about the Exodus. I'll read to you from Amos chapter 2, verse 10. Amos is the earliest of the prophets in the northern kingdom. I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So the idea is obviously alive and well up there in that century. I led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorites. I raised up some of your children to be prophets and some of your youths to be Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel? A prophet, late 8th century, obviously aware of this story. And so are the people he's talking to. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 2 of the same early prophet. Hear this word that the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family that I brought up out of the land of Egypt. You only have I known of all the families on the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for your iniquities. You're special to me, and you're behaving terribly. And they were. And the prophet is reminding them of their story, clearly familiar to them, even though it hasn't yet been written down in the book of Exodus for some hundreds of years. He is in Judah at the same time, Micah, the prophet. Chapter 6, verse 4. He's a contemporary pretty well of Amos and Hosea. And he has this to say. in Judah. Oh, my people, what have I done to you? In what have I wearied you? Answer me, says this sensitive poet prophet. I brought you up from the land of Egypt. This is also late 8th century stuff. I redeemed you from the house of slavery. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. And then it goes on. Hosea 2 speaks of it. Chapter 11, verse 1 to 5. And Hosea is a little bit after Amos, but he's at the time of the destruction of Samaria. And he writes this, says this, found in his scroll. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. And you'll know that that's quoted by Matthew in the story of Jesus and Joseph and Mary going into Egypt. And then he quotes this text as he comes out of Egypt. He comes out of slavery, Jesus does. He's going through the same journey we all went through. And God is drawing him to the promised land and us with him, etc. Don't have to go on about that. The more I called them, says Hosea, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals, false gods, offering incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms. Ephraim, northern kingdom, that's the main part of Joseph, all the hill country of Samaria, in fact. So that's why Ephraim's mentioned. I took them in my arms, but they didn't know that I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like one who lifts an infant to his cheek. I bent down and fed them. And then they want to go back to Egypt. So it goes on. So clearly we're dealing with a story, a long memory that forged them into a people that is well and truly alive in the earliest writings of the Bible. So it goes right back, clearly. Some of the story may have been written prior to the destruction of Samaria. Yes. And we find some of it recorded in the book of Deuteronomy, and that could go back to that time, where it supported Josiah's movement to reconquer and liberate the promised land. Clearly, the Exodus story supported the people in exile. This is the big story. They're in Babylon now, they're not in Egypt. Wouldn't it be wonderful for them to hear again? And then put in writing and have it so they could read it in the synagogue, which began at this time, of course, because they had no temple, so they had to gather somewhere. So you've got this. They found themselves outside their land, longing to return, longing for a new Moses to come and lead them, God, lead them across the desert again to the promised land, home again. Finally, we have the experience of the post-exilic community attempting to form a renewed Israel and recalling the experiences of their beginnings, determined to be faithful to the covenant with God made in the name of their ancestors, a covenant which defines them as a people. The authors, editors of the book of Exodus inherited the story that had been passed through 700 years of Israel's history, and they wrote the story for their contemporaries. They drew on folklore, legends, pieces of narrative composed in Israel and in Judah, and the Deuteronomy, and the prophecies of Amos and Hosea, which I read to you in Micah. As these had been reimagined and re-edited during and after the period of the exile. So the best way, I suggest to you, to read the book of Exodus is to put ourselves among the returned exiles. Think of yourself having gone through that terrible exile and miraculously come back to the land. If you were there when it's unlikely, you'd live that long, but your parents told you what your home was like. You've learned about it, now you're going home to see the land that your parents who were taken into exile remembered. Keeping in mind that the text witnessed to different ways of understanding that history. The influence of the priestly school is apparent in parts of Exodus 1-19, Exodus 20:1-21, the Ten Commandments, and in chapters 25-31 and 35-40. Too much to say in a hurry, but so there are parts of the book of Exodus that are clearly from the priests. There are other parts that are not. The Deuteronomists have had an influence on them too. It's apparent in parts of Exodus 1:19 and in parts of chapter 32-34. The language is not the language of the priests, it's the language of the Deuteronomists. So clearly they're all getting together to produce this text. Besides narrative, the book of Exodus contains law codes, including norms for regulating the cult. It's important that we read these laws as expressions of practices that have come down through the tradition, a tradition that the priestly school understood to be guided by God, Yahweh. These laws express ways in which their ancestors and they themselves have solved various problems that have emerged in the community, as well as ways of organizing personal and communal life in ways that are consistent with their religious insights. Some of the laws you'll find in the book of Exodus clearly apply to the pre-monarchic time. You've just got to read it to see that. Some of them apply to the time when there were kings, because they mention the kings. So it's just as long as you get the idea that there's a range of history here, bits and pieces from many hundreds of years, all being compiled respectfully, contained and organised in this book. Some of the legal material may well have been composed in the Northern Kingdom prior to the collapse of Samaria. Some comes from writers in Judah during the reign of Josiah, and some comes from after the return from the Babylonian exile. And once you're aware of that, it becomes pretty apparent. It's important to observe that those who thought about the essence of Yahwism recognize that not everything is equally central. We've seen this in the Deuteronomic recognition that listening to Yahweh is absolutely basic, as is love of Yahweh. And by love, they mean a commitment to do God's will. And here it is, the text you all know, "Listen, O Israel. Yahweh is your God, Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." Again and again, the prophets rail against those whose focus is locked on a strict observance of legal and ritual matters. Jesus wasn't the first one to have that idea, but who miss the essence of their part in the special covenant they have with God. The problem with the priests, and we're talking about them now, is our problem is that this is the way we do it, this is what's written in the book, these are the rubrics, this is the, and they put it down, and priests are likely in their day, not of course today, likely to see this as the whole blooming thing, you know, that it's kind of about. Well, how about listening to Amos, the earliest of the prophets? He has God say this. It's over the top, but we've got to hear it. I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Oh, I don't think the priests would have taken that too well, do you think? Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I won't accept them, says this. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I won't look upon them. This is eyes, God, as understood by Amos, of course. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the melody of your harps. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. So stop doing all this religious stuff while you're behaving so dreadfully. It's hard to read that without getting caught up in it, isn't it? We've all got to die. Jesus has the same perspective. A better one, of course. He puts the focus on love. Twice we hear him challenge the religious leaders in words taken from Hosea. Go and learn the meaning of the words. What I want is mercy, not sacrifice. No, it doesn't mean I don't want sacrifice. It's a very abrupt way of waking us up to what matters. In other words, by all means, and he says it elsewhere, have your sacrifices, there's a place for them, and they can be beautiful, and they can be aware of the glory of God, and the cult is, it can be stunningly beautiful. But don't do that if you're behaving unjustly. Get your priorities right. I'll probably hurry through this. I may not look at it all only because of time, but this is the New Testament and where we find the book of Exodus being quoted by the authors, certainly, placed on the lips of Jesus, certainly, because that's the way they understood Jesus to be, and highly likely, most of the time, if not all the time, Jesus was quite aware of the book of Exodus, don't worry. So he probably quoted it himself. But well, there's always a little bit of a grey area there. The Gospels give us the real Jesus as understood by the disciples in the light of his death and resurrection. And sometimes, as you would have to do yourself, maybe they place words on the lips of Jesus that perfectly express the heart and meaning and direction of Jesus' life. Wherever they can, of course, they'll quote him. And we're sometimes a little bit unsure what we're dealing with, but we're certainly getting the real Jesus. Well, here we are. Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Exodus chapter 21, if you want to look it up. And it's a very good law. It's a step in the right direction anyhow. Because if you were powerful, I'll be the king for the moment, and you do something to hurt me, you steal one of my lambs, I can wipe out your whole bloody herd. Because I've got the power to do it. No, says the book of Exodus. If they take one of your lambs, okay, you can take one of theirs. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You can, it's not perfect, it's not love your enemies, but it's bringing some order into justice that is not dependent on might being right. So it's actually a good law. But Jesus goes well beyond it, as you know. Here's Matthew again in reference to John the Baptist. Jesus, in the lips of Jesus we hear, this is the one about whom it is written, I send my messenger ahead of you. It's a very good way of talking about John the Baptist, highly likely from Jesus' own lips, certainly placed on his lips by Matthew. All the gospel writers portray Jesus as fulfilling one of the most powerful scenes of the book of Exodus, which is God feeding his people as they journey through the wilderness to the promised land. And you don't have to think that that's an actual record of exactly what happened. They complain, for example, they haven't got any food. That's actually a little bit odd, because a few chapters earlier they had thousands of cattle they were taking with them. Well, if that's not food, what the heck is it? But anyhow, that's forgotten. So they have no food, and God sends quails, you know, which the quails were known to appear in this part of the desert, part near the sea. And then the manna, and people work out what the manna probably was. It was something exuded from certain bushes that was you could eat and sustain you. But that's their bits and pieces you can look at. But the story itself is saying something huger than that. It's saying that what fed the people as they journeyed through the promised land was God fed them. They survived, so they were looked after by God. And then you have this wonderful story of the manna. In the New Testament, similarly, we're being told by the Gospel writers that what we need to nourish us on our journey through our desert is Jesus, and he's the one who gives us to eat. And of course we express that in the ritual of the Mass. That's what we're doing at the Mass. But the Mass is about this, not this about the Mass. So the Eucharist is a ritual way of expressing our faith that our nourishment comes from the risen Christ. And that's told in a story too, exactly drawing on the book of Exodus about Jesus and the crowd and so on. John is especially interesting. After portraying Jesus nourishing the crowd in the wilderness, he has the people catch up with Jesus in the synagogue at Capernaum. And they ask Jesus, this is in chapter 6, they ask him for a sign, and they quote from Psalm 78 verse 24, which declares that God gave the people bread from heaven to eat. That's what they say. Jesus says, John writes, Jesus says, very truly I tell you, and I'm attracted by this. Some scholars tell us that, especially in John, where there are long, whole chapters of monologue from Jesus, they're meditations on the meaning. But when you find, this is not certain, but I think it's right, when you find anywhere in Matthew, Mark, Luke or John, the statement, very truly I tell you, amen, amen, I say to you, however you translate it, you're actually hitting the actual words of Jesus. That's their cue for letting you know this is what Jesus said. And then they go on to reflect on it, meditate on it, open it up, etc., in a meditation. So, Jesus probably said this, and they remembered it. Very truly I tell you, it was not Moses who gave you bread from heaven. It's my Father who gives you the bread from heaven. Not gave, but gives. Not Moses, but my Father. For the bread of God is that which comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And they said to him, Sir, give us this bread always. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. So the whole passage, the whole meditation is drawn from the book of Exodus. It's taking them back to their sacred book. When the rich young man asks Jesus how to get eternal life, Jesus says, well, you know the commandments. And he learnt them from Mary, Joseph probably. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not defraud, honour your father and your mother. So Jesus was well aware of these are not the 10 commandments, these are the 7 commandments that are about our behaviour, the others are about God. So this is the social sins. And then Jesus goes a step a long way further, and he said, oh, look, how beautiful, do you really want to live? And he said, yeah. He said, well, look, you're living a very cluttered life at the moment, so let that go. Give. There's poor people around who need what you've got, and you don't need all this, so get rid of it and come and join us, come follow me. Brackets, Jesus probably thought, it's upsetting my whole plan because I've got 12 and now I'm going to have 13. But anyway, he said, I'll cope. So, you know, come and join me. And sadly, we're told, I don't know what happened in the next verse, but this beautiful young man, first time the word used, Jesus looked at him and loved him. So there's obviously a wonderful connection between them. He went away sad because he had many possessions. He couldn't let it go. To do what he really wanted. It's not as if you let it go and then work out what you want. His deepest yearnings were going in one direction, and he was cluttering everything up on other directions. And Jesus saying, okay, I'd love you to be with me, you'd love to be with us. Come, you're very welcome, but you can't come with all that garbage, baggage. He's quoting from Exodus. Jesus quotes from the Torah in an attempt to free the Sadducees from their ignorance. The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in afterlife. And by the way, the Bible doesn't talk about any of that until very late. So no one believed in it before the time of the Maccabees. So it was, they just presumed death is death. And they, in fact, were very much against the idea of an afterlife because the Egyptians, as you well know, were very much in favour of it. So they saw it as a kind of paganism, really, this escape to another world. This is the world, you've got to live justly here and lovingly here, and when you die, you die. And the Egyptians have got it all wrong, so they're kind of psychologically thinking. And Jesus has got another view. As for the dead being raised, haven't you read in the book of Moses, Exodus, in the story about the bush? God said to them, I'm the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. You're very wrong, he goes on. You don't understand the scripture and you don't understand God. He's talking to the chief priests and everybody. God is the God of Abraham. He's the God of the living, not the dead. So Abraham is living. Let's move to the book of Leviticus. What I jumped over then were many other passages where in the New Testament, in the Gospels, the reference is back to the book of Exodus. I think you've got the general idea. Book of Leviticus. The key role played by the priestly school in the production of the Torah is most apparent in Leviticus, where from the content, the language and the style, it's apparent that the entire book is the product of the priestly school. We're not speaking of a document that was written at one time or by a single group of priests. There are clear signs that Leviticus chapter 17 to 26 is a later work that qualifies and supplements legislation found in earlier work. But it's an ongoing, updated statement about the cult. Now, where do they put it? In the Moses is the tabernacle. They're still on Sinai, the Ten Commandments have been given, and then they're going to set out on their journey. So the book of Leviticus is plonked in there, all revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai at the foot of the mountain just before he hurtles off on his journey. Well, of course it wasn't done then, it's a much, much later document, but it's sacred and so it's part of the revelation. And the revelation is always by the priest associated with Sinai. And that's quite beautiful. Nor should we imagine the priests who composed the book of Leviticus, chapters 1 to 16, as creating their text out of nothing. First of all, there's the obvious fact that they were drawing on centuries of practice, sacrifices, cult, especially from the cult in the Jerusalem temple, but also from centuries in the northern kingdom, such as Shiloh. When the northern refugees came down, they brought with them their practices, some of which were very beautiful and no doubt incorporated into the Jerusalem temple. What was said in relation to the legal and cultic laws of Exodus is even more important here. For Jesus, love is the origin and goal of everything we do. And here we have in Matthew 5:33, for example, Jesus quotes from Leviticus when he speaks of truth and simplicity, and he says, you've heard that it was said in ancient times, quoting Leviticus, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord, quoting from there, and you know what he goes on to say. But I say to you, let every word of yours be yes. If it's yes, make it yes. If it's no, make it no, etc. Don't swear to support. Don't bring God into support. Just speak the truth. Matthew 22:39, Jesus quotes from Leviticus to speak of the essential importance. He says, the second command is it, love your neighbour as yourself. Beautiful statement taken from the book of Leviticus, chapter 19. You've heard, Matthew 5, heard that it was said to those in ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you've made to the Lord. But I say to you, I brought this in earlier, but anyhow, let your word be yes, yes, or no, now. Anything else comes from the evil one. Leviticus 13, I won't say it here, but the laws about how to treat people with leprosy. And it talks about them, and then you watch Jesus breaking that law. Doesn't even think of obeying it. A leper comes and says, "You can make me clean." And Jesus said, "Of course I want to." And he hugs him to himself. Well, God said back in Leviticus, you're not allowed to do that. So it's a law. It has a value. It's an early medical thing, I suppose. It's not without value. But there are much more important things here. And Jesus goes to the heart of it. There's the whole question of adultery. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbour, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. Story, Jesus, John chapter 8. It's not actually part of John's gospel, but anyhow, it's in there. It's tucked in there. It's a loose story finding its way into John's gospel at a good place. And you know what Jesus did. He gets down on the ground with the woman, and then he looks at them all and says, "Well, if you want to carry out the law, if you want to stone her, how about anyone who is without sin? You start the stoning." Then he eyeballed them all. And they had enough wisdom to think, "I think I might go out. I might leave it to the others." And they went away, beginning with the eldest. "It's all you young people, you're okay." So, you know that story. And he says, "Don't sin again." He's not saying it's okay. But he's not condemning her in her sin or punishing her because of her sin. He's loving her out of it if she wants to be loved out of it. And I'm pretty sure she does. There's that other. Romans 10, Galatians. They're often quoting from the book of Leviticus, so of course they're familiar with it. Jesus is familiar with it. The New Testament authors are familiar with it. And they quote it, but they're always going beyond it. Finally, the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers follows the Israelites from Sinai to Moab. So Exodus brings them to Sinai and the mountain, and the revelation. Leviticus is in the little gap between the end of Sinai and the journey. Numbers, constructed of course, takes us from the beginning of the journey to the end of the journey. So between a lot of them, they do the whole wilderness journey. Baruch Levine writes in the introduction to his first volume of his commentary on Numbers. I think I mentioned yesterday, when I was preparing my work, of course I went to Jewish commentators, others as well, but particularly Jewish commentators, because what else should you do if you're looking at the Torah? And so he's written a number of volumes on Numbers, and I did mention the man who's written three volumes on the book of Leviticus. So, yeah, and scholarship's the same, whether you're a Jewish writer or a Catholic, Anglican, whatever. It's science, so you've got to do it as honestly as you can, and they do, and they're all helping each other. Well, Baruch Levine, in his introduction to the book of Numbers, writes, "It would be accurate to state, in summary, that the priestly materials in Numbers chapter 1 to 20, brackets, as in Numbers as a whole, represent, by and large, the further development of priestly law and historiography well into the post-exilic period. What they had in the book of Exodus and Leviticus wasn't sufficient to help them have a cult that was beautiful after the return from exile. So they had to compose another book. They didn't interfere with, because by now writing is becoming more important, they didn't just readjust Leviticus or Exodus, they actually write a new book. It's the book of Numbers. Such development was not merely a matter of redactional activity, but also involved new writings by the post-exilic priesthood in Jerusalem and their associates, all placed back at the time of Moses and the exile, to give it dignity. And they felt that what they were writing is consistent with the traditions of their people. So it wasn't a new idea that they came up with. It was an attempt to reapply the basic principles of their common faith. Here's Mark chapter 9, one of the scenes in the Gospel of John comes to Jesus. John and his brother James, called Boanerges, sons of thunder. They must have been a pretty cantankerous couple, these brothers. And then John ends up being the very gentle one at the end of his life that drove everybody mad because all he ever preached on was love. So you can become gentle with age. Cheer up. Here's this scene. John says to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop them. He wasn't following, he wasn't one of us." I'm not going to have that happening. And here's Jesus, "Look, don't stop him. No one who does a miracle in my name will be able to soon after to speak ill of me. If they're not against us, they're for us." That's a beautiful little statement of Jesus. Moses is even more beautiful, I think, if I may say that to Jesus. I think Jesus should have improved it a bit. Now, you know the story is Moses is there and he's been told to do it, so he does it, and he gets 70 elders to go up onto the mountain, and the Spirit will come down upon them on the mountain, and they will speak in prophetic words. It's all very wonderful. And then Joshua, the Moses offsider, comes up to, it's almost word for word, that's where it comes from, comes up to Moses, "Hey, there's two blokes down in the camp and they never came up with us. They didn't go to St. Paul's Seminary and get ordained or to Manly or wherever else. They're not ordained and they're down there and they're prophesying in your name, like in God's name. We should stop them." And Moses says, "Don't stop them." It's quite beautiful. "If only everyone in Israel was a prophet." God, that's good. Stop stopping people, for God's sake. Wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody was speaking for God in every culture, in every place, whether they grew up, whatever. That's what we want to see, Spirit alive. So that's Moses, and obviously whoever wrote this, namely Mark, is applying it to Jesus and his life. Ezra the priest and Nehemiah the governor in the middle of the 5th century, getting close now to the end, the Persian army in 458 BC was defeated in Egypt, backed by the Athenian navy. We're getting into history that some of us are a bit familiar with. It's probable that this was the occasion for a further attempt by the Persian administration to strengthen Judah as a buffer against Egypt, because the Persian army was defeated by Egypt. Egypt's getting stronger with Athenian backing. So Ezra, one of their processes, they sent Ezra, a scribe, a civil servant, and a priest. He was sent over from Jerusalem with 5,000 more returning exiles in the middle of the 5th century. And his job was to set up the cult and whatever. It's likely that Ezra, in conjunction with the local priests and chief landowners, was responsible for the final drawing up of what we call the Torah in the middle of the 5th century BC. So they've all got a say. They've all been doing some work. A lot of work, because most of the Jews in Babylon never came home. They were doing quite well where they were, don't worry. Rothschild's bank was already established. I think that's not true, but something like that. So Jews tend to do pretty well where they go. So they were over there, and most of them stayed there. And they were working on all this too. So Ezra came back with a lot of insight, a lot of result of study from the people back in Babylon. And when he met there, he met people who were working on it here. And between the lot of them, they organized what we now call the Torah. Megabyzes, one of the leading Persian generals who had been governor of Syria, instigated a revolt, and in the subsequent violence, the walls of Jerusalem were broken down and the gates burned. And you read that in the book of Nehemiah. And the city was laid waste once again. Not even the recently rebuilt temple was spared. So in 445 BC, probably, Nehemiah was a Jewish civil servant, was sent from Babylon as governor of Judah to rebuild the walls, reorganize it, etc. He was commissioned to repopulate and fortify the city and establish the rule of law based on the injunctions of the Torah. The Persians wanted all these subject people to have their law clear and a copy of it sent to the Persian archives so the Persian king knew what they were doing, and he might have a say in it too if he wanted to. So he didn't want everyone to be just doing what he wanted them to do their own thing, but they really wanted to know what that thing was. So that's all part of this process too. So the priestly writers are focusing on something very beautiful. They're focusing on the presence of God, the mystery of God, the sacred, the cloud, present in the community, beyond our capacity to control or anything. And then we find the most beautiful way in music and prayer to respond to that. The prophets keep saying, that's wonderful, but make sure your life is what it is appropriately. And what we've done as Christians, we, the baptism of Jesus, we baptize now into the Christian community. And everyone baptized is a priest, clearly. Priestly people live where they belong. You've baptized a priest, a prophet, and a king. Every one of us is shared. There's only one priest in the Christian world, and that's Jesus. And everyone, by baptism, shares in that priesthood. Priesthood means mediating of grace, surrounding other people with a presence, bringing the presence of God from the temple, which is your body, all of us, bringing that to others, a sacred encounter. Of course that happens in the community, of course it happens in our gatherings, etc. But it's personal, and then we know we've got, so a wife is a priest to her husband, a husband to a wife, a godparent to a godchild, a public servant to the community, a uncle to a nephew or a niece. We're all called to share in the priesthood of Christ. In our long tradition, we've also particularly guarded, in fact we've added a sacrament for those who are called to a irreplaceable role, really, to mediate grace to the assembled community, to the body, but to the whole body. We call that the priesthood of the ordained, the sacrament of order in the church. And for a long time, and for really, really good reasons, it was impossible to do anything else. That was a male function, as was every function in society, by the way. Was male, because the males lived in the outside world. The woman was there to nurture the male, nurture the children, you know, all that. They didn't have a place in law, or in policing, or in government, or... But that's all happened since. That's all happened. And our church, instead of being at the forefront of all this, is lagging behind. We're still staying with the male celibate clergy. It's a beautiful thing to be, of course, if one has the gift of celibacy. It fits priesthood perfectly, so I can see why the church nourishes it. And I feel privileged to have been called into that life of an ordained priest. But you know what we're doing at the moment? We're depriving people of the Eucharist to keep the system the way it should be. It's got to go. And we've got people, particularly younger women sometimes, giving up on the church because it's got this glass ceiling. And it seems that authority, even though in Iran you can have a woman who's running the country. Why am I saying all this? I'm not exactly sure. But I'm trying to say priesthood. That's what the book is about, the sacred. And we're all called to do that. Shouldn't we be all called to do it in the public arena today? I think it's totally obvious. Shouldn't we be ordaining leaders to lead? Married, single, divorced, gay, heterosexual, who cares? What's it all? Leaders we need. And until our church actually embraces that ahead of everybody, not puffing and panting and coming along behind, you get that going, for God's sake. We'll renew everything. Imagine the energy that would come into the church if we had this kind of leadership rather than 79-year-olds who are nearly about to drop, still running the show. Go in peace. See you at 4 o'clock.